From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. In testimony on Capitol Hill today, the nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said he's cautiously optimistic about the development of a vaccine for the coronavirus.
We will be able to make them available to the American public, as I said to this committee months ago, within a year from when we started, which would put us at the end of this calendar year and the beginning of 2021.
He also expressed worry, though, about the way the virus is spiking in parts of the country.
The next couple of weeks are going to be critical in our ability to address those surges that we're seeing in Florida, in Texas, in Arizona, and in other states.
Dr. Fauci said the U.S. will conduct more testing, despite President Trump saying at that campaign rally in Tulsa over the weekend that he told his staff to slow the testing down. Today, the president continues his reelection campaign with a visit to Arizona, a place where cases are continuing to surge. The state has been reopening since mid-May when stay-at-home orders expired. Trump is also meeting with local officials and community leaders to discuss border security and survey parts of the U.S.-Mexico border fence in Yuma. Let's bring in KJZZ reporter Kathy Ritchie, who's in Phoenix. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with the president's visit there today. How are people feeling about it?
You know, I'd say the reaction is probably mixed. He's coming to Arizona as infections are spiking, and he's in Yuma to talk about border issues. Then he'll be in Phoenix at a rally at a church called the Dream City Church, which can hold about 3,000 people. The church has also tweeted about some newly installed technology that kills 99% of COVID within 10 minutes. And that people can go in knowing that when you're there, you'll be safe and protected.
Wait, Phoenix, so you're saying that they have technology that kills 90, or they're saying they have technology. It'd be nice if they shared that with the rest of us.
Absolutely. Yeah. Apparently one of the church members developed this technology. And so we'll see if it works.
Well, and Arizona's got obviously mixed politics, a Democratic mayor in Phoenix, Republican governor in the state. How are they talking about this visit by the president?
Well, Mayor Kate Gallego is obviously, she's not happy. She issued a statement yesterday saying the rally was not sanctioned or permitted by the city. And for that matter, the organizers aren't following CDC guidelines for COVID-19. On the other hand, Republican Governor Doug Ducey, he's been listed as a special guest, and he said in the past that he'll protect people's rights to assemble in an election year. You know, something else, Jeremy, Mayor Gallego said that the city won't be policing face masks. They won't be reimbursing those face masks during the president's event at the church. But she said that she hopes the president and the governor, you know, lead by example and wear masks.
Well, we do know that the case count is surging in Arizona. Give us a sense of how severe the COVID crisis is there at this point.
You know, I would say it's dire. More than 55,000 people have contracted COVID-19 and more than 1,300 have died. And the number of new cases each day has gone up more than 135% over the last 14 days. And 20% of the tests are coming back positive. So another thing, hospitalizations, ICU beds, those are going up too. The state started seeing this increase roughly about 2 weeks after the stay-at-home order ended on May 15th. Unfortunately, the reality is people weren't being careful. Bars and clubs were packed. So we're seeing a lot of infections in people ages 20 to 44.
Well, and does the state have a plan to get this spike under control?
You know, at this point, there are no plans to shut down the state again, but the governor has faced tremendous pressure to do something. Up until recently, Ducey attributed the surge in numbers to more testing, but it's pretty clear that there's widespread transmission of the virus in the community. And, you know, until last week, the governor prohibited towns and cities from imposing their own health requirements, like face masks. And this was a huge problem for places, for example, like the tiny town of Guadalupe, which is wedged between Phoenix and Tempe. Guadalupe was hit really hard by COVID, and their COVID cases are 4 times higher than the county. I spoke to the mayor a few weeks ago, and she was really frustrated that she couldn't mandate face coverings for her community. Finally, last week at a press conference, Ducey relented, and he left it up to cities and towns to mandate those face coverings. And for the first time, we actually started seeing the governor himself wearing a face covering after being criticized for not wearing a mask. So the approach is more testing, encourage people to practice social distancing, and wear face coverings. But, you know, restaurants and stores are, for the most part, open. Though we have seen some voluntarily close for a couple of weeks after an employee tested positive for the virus.
It'll be interesting to see if the governor is wearing a mask with President Trump today, who has not been wearing a mask in public. The state of Arizona is a place a lot of people go to retire. What's happening with the state's older population with this spike in COVID?
You know, that's an area that I cover a lot. And I think I'd say it's really bad for those who live in long-term care, Jeremy. We've seen some federal data about the number of cases and deaths in skilled nursing homes. But Arizona has more than 2,000 assisted living facilities, and we have little to no information about the number of cases and deaths in those specific facilities. You know, a judge ruled that the state health officials don't have to share that information with the public. You know, the reality is it's been 3 months since most families were allowed to visit, and they are the eyes and ears of these facilities. They're the ones who report concerns or complaints, and that's not happening now.
That is Kathy Ritchie, a reporter with KJZZ in Phoenix. Kathy, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Immigration hardliners are praising President Trump's move yesterday to temporarily suspend U.S. visas for foreigners seeking highly skilled seasonal and au pair work. But business groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and leaders from companies like Google are criticizing the move, along with immigration advocates. Muzaffar Chishti is a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you give us some perspective? How many foreign workers will not be able to come to the U.S. for the rest of the year under this new order? And what effect will this have on the economy?
Well, the proclamation issued by the president yesterday, which goes into effect tomorrow, adds a new bunch of immigrant workers who will not be allowed to come to the U.S. till December. But it also extends a proclamation that was issued 2 months earlier, till December 31st. So if you look at the combined effect of these two, we believe it affects about 325,000 potential workers not being allowed to come to the U.S. And the concerns are that it affects important aspects of our economy in the technology area, in academia and education, landscaping, hotels, construction, seasonal jobs.
I want to ask you more about the impact, but first I want to ask you about the administration's rationale. They say it's protecting American jobs. Will Americans fill these jobs now?
Well, it came in the context of COVID. So we have become the world's first country which has decided to put immigration restrictions in the middle of COVID, not on the basis of health restrictions, but on the basis of its impact on U.S. workers. So in that regard, we are extremely unusual. But we believe that it will have minimal effect on the employment of U.S. workers because most of the workers coming through these programs are coming to do jobs that U.S. workers typically are not available to do or not qualified to do.
In the H-1B category of high-skilled workers, 85,000 visas will be given out, not in a lottery system, but to the highest-paid workers. The rationale is that it prevents lower-level high-tech workers from taking jobs that Americans could fill. Who, apart from the administration, wanted that change?
Well, there's a strong lobbying groups in the U.S. of people who believe that H-1B program is hurting U.S. workers. Some of it are organized sections of the IT industry, and some are from well-known organizations in the U.S. whose principal goal is to reduce immigration.
The administration is also extending restrictions on family members of green card holders. It's also restricting visas for students, and you mentioned au pairs. The thinking is that people overstay. Is that a problem that needs fixing?
Well, first of all, on the family members, that was put into place 2 months ago, so this just extends that. And it sort of limits immigration in the future for basically spouses and minor kids of U.S. citizens. That's a big change in our admission system. With respect to J-1 workers, which is a number of these sort of exchange visitors, including au pairs, there is very little evidence that they overstay because they typically want to keep on having the option of returning back to the U.S. in the future.
The president, as we've been talking about, cited high unemployment for this decision. This comes as the president campaigns for re-election. Your thoughts on this? Is this just politics?
Well, I think it is clearly smells more of politics just because COVID was used as the foundation for doing it. And this has very little relevance to COVID. So when the unemployment numbers started inching, it was clear that the president was pivoting. And he did it quite affirmatively by talking about unemployment rates in certain states, which are key to his election. So not to see it as connected to election, would be, I think, stretching our imagination.
That's Muzaffer Chishti. He is a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Ed.
In the ongoing protests against police violence and racism, we've heard many activists say they want to defund or reimagine police forces. Well, one aspect of that is the role that guns play in American law enforcement. Police shot and killed more than 1,000 people last year in the United States. Compare that to the United Kingdom, where police fatally shot just 3 people. Note that in the UK, most officers do not carry firearms. To talk more about the role of guns in policing, we're joined now by Tracy Mears, professor and founding director of the Justice Collaboratory at Yale Law School. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So there are countries where police officers don't always carry guns or don't carry guns at all. Certain officers, they include the UK, Ireland, Norway, Iceland, New Zealand. Just how prevalent are guns in law enforcement in the U.S. compared with other countries?
Well, basically every sworn police officer in a policing agency in the United States carries a gun. That's part of what it means to be a sworn police officer. So the norm here is for police officers to carry a gun rather than not to carry a gun, which is what you see in other countries.
And why is that, and has it always been the case?
No, it hasn't always been the case that police officers had a service revolver. If you look historically at the original police in urban areas, the night watchman carried a stick, not a gun. So that was not historically true. Although I do think to the extent that, policing finds some of its historical origins in more informal arrangements with municipalities. Many people point to slave patrols, for example, as part of the origin story of police. Folks carried the guns that they had. They weren't actually officially sworn agents of the state doing that kind of work.
How often do police use their guns, and do we know how often they shoot when they do draw their guns?
So one of the things that people should understand about policing is that much of the policy around policing as a profession has proceeded in a way that, compared to other professions, is evidence-free. We don't have standardized federal data collection. Certain agencies have adopted use of force policies locally, so those agencies are better situated to answer that specific question, how often. But you cannot answer that question with any kind of specificity with respect to every one of the agencies across the country. To the extent that we do have answers to that question, I would say the typical police officer doesn't fire his or her gun very often. But that is not to say that we don't have many, many, many incidents of shootings that sometimes end in death of civilians, as we have become increasingly aware of over time.
Do you think that we arm too many police officers in America?
Yes.
Why?
We know that police are called upon to do many, many tasks for which there's no particular reason to believe that that officer would need to use deadly force. And yet they are trained to be prepared to use deadly force should, quote unquote, things go awry. And I understand the impulse, but it's kind of like saying that, you know, everyone should have to drive a four-wheel SUV because it might snow in a context in which most of the time it's not even cold, let alone snowy.
Obviously, we're having this conversation right now because of the nationwide protests sparked by the killing of George Floyd. Is the fact that police are armed part of the problem when it comes to police killings of black people in particular in the U.S., do you think?
You know, I think one of the dynamics that's at issue here is the ways in which police are called to respond to incidents in race class subjugated communities, to use a term offered by my colleagues Vashla Weaver and Joe Saas, where violence is prevalent. You know, I think about places where I've worked, such as Chicago, Baltimore, and other places, you know, where police will be called in to deal with or quell serious violence. Police will say that, you know, they need to be armed to deal with gun violence in those communities. And I completely understand the need in some cases. It's also the case, however, that we know that there are many ways of quelling violence and building more sturdy structures within communities so that violence can be depressed. And the people who are doing that work are not themselves armed, which I think, you know, provide some evidence to say that sending in armed first responders to deal with gun violence is not the only way or even the best way to address violence in those communities.
I'm sure that if I was going to talk to somebody from law enforcement about this, one argument we would hear is that because so many Americans are armed, the police have to be armed. Otherwise, it's not a fair fight, no matter what the situation is. What do you say to that?
I would say that police are right to recognize that there are too many guns in this country. And the research that we have been able to undertake in a context of a very disfavorable landscape toward doing research about gun violence and the relationship between the availability of guns and gun violence definitely points to the prevalence of guns being a problem and, you know, has been relied upon, as you suggest, by police to justify them carrying guns, which is not the case in other countries, right? So we were talking about the UK. There aren't a lot of guns there. You know, police are disarming folks with knives in the UK. That said, I would say that there are many, many state agencies interacting with people in the very same communities that see a great deal of violence in this country. I'm thinking of representatives from the Department of Children and Family Services, for example, or, you know, teachers, but certainly other representatives of state agencies in the same places where police say that they're concerned about, you know, the possibility of folks having guns. And none of those workers claims that they need to be armed. So again, I think the better way to for police to think about the necessity of arms is not that they're going places where people might have a gun, but instead, what is the kind of incident that you are going to? And is it the kind of incident where you should reasonably expect to have to use, you know, a gun to address it? And I think once we start asking those questions and taking them seriously, we will conclude that not every officer actually needs to be armed.
Is there a solution, or what would be the first thing you would suggest to get at least the number of guns down among police officers who you don't feel like need them on them all the time? Is there some way where only certain police would have guns or something like that? Is there a model you can think of?
I think that it's some combination of specialization within the existing police force. That is, you know, having people trained to do certain tasks and then being confident that, you know, some folks who are trained to do certain tasks don't need to be armed with guns is one way to do it. You know, another way to do it would be to substitute some of those sworn police officers for civilians within the force. Similarly, again, trained to do certain things. You know, do we really need an armed first responder to address a person like Eric Garner selling loose cigarettes on a corner? Mm-hmm. It seems to me not that we don't. But this also brings up an important point, Jeremy, which is, again, police officers are authorized to carry out certain laws, and there is a proliferation of relatively low-level ordinances, offenses, and the like that police officers are authorized to carry out with force. And I think once we start taking a look at it from that end, we can put a little bit of responsibility, maybe a lot of responsibility, on city councils and legislatures to be much more specific about what police are authorized to do when carrying out these kinds of offenses and ordinances. Many of them don't need to be enforced by forcible arrest. And I imagine that once we start cutting off the legal authorization for police to use forcible arrest, we will see an impact on police use of guns as well.
That is Tracy Mears, who's a professor and founding director of the Justice Collaboratory at Yale Law School. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
As states across the country figure out how to hold an election during a pandemic, California has decided that all registered voters will get a mail-in ballot for November. President Trump strongly opposes mail-in voting, claiming the move will lead to wide-scale fraud and vote rigging, even though he has voted by mail. KQED's Scott Schaefer spoke to election officials in counties President Trump won 4 years ago to find out what they think.
Soon after Governor Gavin Newsom ordered that all registered voters in California be sent a mail-in ballot, President Trump was criticizing it.
They send out, like in California, millions and millions of ballots to anybody that's breathing.
Actually, only those registered to vote will get ballots. But the president's general point is that he believes vote-by-mail ballots are easier to tamper with. Governor Newsom pushed back.
This is a health issue. I hope we can temper our comments on the other side, though I recognize we're in a political season.
Soon after Newsom issued his order, he was sued by the National and California Republican parties. Their attorney, Harmeet Dhillon, says they have nothing against voting by mail if it's done right.
The chaotic way in which the governor is proposing to run this election, which is not the way that they've been run in the past, the lack of preparation, which I've heard from county registrars of voters, and that's why I'm concerned. That's why I filed a lawsuit.
Since that lawsuit was filed, the legislature passed a bill confirming Newsom's order, which addresses some but not all of the concerns raised in that lawsuit. Shasta is one of the California counties that gave Trump a huge margin over Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. Elections Chief Kathy Darling Allen says most voters there have been voting by mail for years, and the number of times she found someone casting a ballot illegally?
That happened one time.
Once since 2004. Allen says it's hard to say why the president would question the process, given the results in her county.
In Shasta County, he got 62% of the vote in 2016, and many, many of those ballots were vote by mail.
In Tehama County, another Trump stronghold, Election Chief Jennifer Weiss says they put a lot of effort into verifying ballots.
We all check the signature against those signatures on file, and if the signatures do not match, the voter is notified.
Weiss says what concerns her about November isn't fraud, it's the coronavirus.
You know, and I'm not necessarily comfortable putting my poll workers in that position where their health and safety is at risk.
Trump also did very well in Amador County by the Sierra foothills, where Chief Deputy Registrar Mark Hammergren notes that each absentee ballot has barcodes to help prevent fraud.
There's so many checks and balances that goes into the process that I don't want to say impossible because anything's possible, but it's damn near impossible.
His message for people who hear news stories about voter fraud? Come on down.
You can watch us check in ballots, check signatures. You can watch us how we sort them, how we scan them.
Election officials dislike uncertainty, especially in a presidential election. Clerk recorder Cammie Foote says she can't tell the Inyo County Board of Supervisors exactly how the November election will be carried out.
Because we have executive orders, we have legal challenges, we have legislation in different parts of the process, so I don't actually really know yet.
Kim Alexander, president of the California Voter Foundation, says there will always be some problems with elections, whether or not they're vote by mail.
Is it going to be perfect? No. But voters should be able to feel confident going into this election that if they follow the instructions and they get their ballots in on time, their ballots are going to be counted and their votes are going to count.
And that counting, with all those mail-in ballots, could take a very long time. For Here and Now, I'm Scott Schaefer.
As more Americans call for police reform, some experts say the next step in the conversation is taking a closer look at policing technology. Amazon recently announced a one-year moratorium on police agencies using its facial recognition software. Ruha Benjamin is a professor of African American studies at Princeton University and author of Race After Technology. She joins us now on this and what she calls the new Jim Code. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. So you've shared many memories of your time growing up in Los Angeles, seeing boys lined up for police pat downs or the sound of helicopters overhead. And now you say that those same modes of surveillance and policing actually continue, but they're less visible to the eye, something you call the new Jim Code. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Absolutely. And so, you know, right now we're in a moment where more and more people are becoming aware and rallying around the need to defund the police. But there are many ways in which policing happens in our lives without the flesh and blood presence of actual police. And many of these are surveillance technologies that look at people and you don't even know that you're being watched or tracked. And so facial recognition software is one of these that's used both in the public and private sector. And in the last week, many of the companies that produce this technology have actually said that they would stop offering it to the police because they understand that it aids and abets the unwarranted tracking and surveillance of people. And so I'm hoping that for those who are aware of the profiling that actual police do, they can start to become aware of the way that the technology also profiles communities.
You mentioned these companies. Amazon is one of them. They announced they would no longer let police use their facial recognition technology for a year. But Amazon's public decision makes clear that this software is being created and owned by private entities. What's the role of regulation, do you feel, in these tools, which are now privatized?
It's really not enough for companies to offer this kind of short-term moratoria on the use of facial recognition for police only, because there are many, many institutions, organizations in both the public and private sector that employ it. For example, at UCLA, it was one of the first schools to announce its intention to use automated software to decide who could come on campus and not. And the only reason why it's not using it is because an independent entity, a digital rights nonprofit, actually audited the software that it was going to use and found that there were 58 false positives. That means students, faculty, and staff that were matched with a criminal record and were predominantly people of color. And these were false matches. And so imagine being a student or faculty and having this system flag you as not supposed to be on campus, as someone who is an intruder, and then what that kicks in terms of campus police or LAPD. And so UCLA is just one of many places that has considered or is already using some kind of automated facial recognition program that makes all kinds of technical mistakes, but those technical mistakes often target the very people who are most vulnerable to police violence.
I mean, this really gets at bias within these algorithms, which evaluate risk or identify these crime hotspots, or even we've talked about on this show, California's gang database. But they're designed to supposedly take out the bias in policing, but you argue that's impossible.
Exactly. So these technologies are produced in a context that is awash with discrimination and bias. That means we have to train these technologies, these programs to make decisions. And so part of that training is deciding how to teach it to look for a threat, for example, or how to predict that someone is going to do something wrong. And all those predictions and that training is based on historic decisions that organizations, police, teachers, doctors have made in the past. So if those people have been making discriminatory patterns and decisions, that's feeding the algorithm. The algorithm, the smarter it gets, many times, the more biased it's becoming. That means it's mirroring human decisions and actions. And so the real danger is that people stop questioning it just because it's a technology. We think it's more neutral than, let's say, a racist judge or officer or teacher because it's coming to us through a screen. But someone had to teach that screen to make that decision and had to design that program. And that's what we need to keep an eye on.
Perhaps what you just said is the answer to my next question, but in this current moment where most people support reimagining what the police could look like, what might reform look like in this technological policing state or this new Jim Code, as you call it?
I really want us to think about what is at stake with maintaining the police as an institution. What's the origin of policing? We know that it came out of slave patrols. And so it's not an accident that the people who are most harmed by this institution are the descendants of people who were enslaved. And so the root of the institution is rotten. And so rather than thinking about how to sort of tweak the edges of it, I think we have to reimagine and rethink what actually constitutes safety and well-being in our communities. And so we have to be very wary that you might defund the police, the actual people who are walking and patrolling neighborhoods, but policing may continue through technology. And I think part of our goal in this moment is not to let that happen, to be vigilant so that the racist forms of policing that we're up against don't just shapeshift, become more invisible and impenetrable and unaccountable. And so let's go to the root causes and think about what will actually make us safe.
We're talking about it in the context of these tools used by police and private companies, but there are also these apps like Citizen, which is a crowdsource tool that essentially gives folks information about incidents or crimes in a neighborhood. And now there's this contact tracing for COVID-19 that's become more available. How do we make sense of these apps and evaluate whether to use them or not and the risk of that?
And so partly, and I love that you brought up the apps that everyday people use, because it's not just big institutions and organizations using technologies. We're all kind of enrolled in this process of tracking one another. And so if we know that this tracking is patterned according to race, like a lot of people use these kind of next door apps and things where they're looking around their neighborhood, who's an intruder, who's supposed to be here or not, all of those perceptions are shaped by racial bias and class bias. And so who's likely to be reported on the Nextdoor app or, you know, sort of the Citizen app? And so there's no way to sort of take these technologies out of the social context. They are mirrors for us. They are mirrors for society. They're reflecting back at us our biases and our patterns of discrimination. And so to the extent that we can use them as mirrors and then try to deal with the root causes, they are useful. But if we really think that they're somehow neutral, that we should be making consequential decisions based on what's coming to us from these technologies, we're only going to deepen the inequalities that we're living with right now.
So would you recommend using these contact tracing tools for COVID-19?
On the one hand, I'm always wary of something that's just going to be a tech fix for something that's really a harder problem to deal with and where there might be analog solutions like old school public health. But just on a basic level, like even if I was gung-ho about contact tracing itself, the idea you would need, let's say, a smartphone for this to work, you would need everyone to have a smartphone. And just the inequalities that we have where many, many people, 40% or more, don't have the basic device that would make this useful. That's a first sort of issue that I see with it. And then the other is that it's like the facial recognition stuff. There's a lot of false positives when it comes to contact tracing technology. I mean, the fact that it will tell you that you were in touch with someone or not in touch with someone who's a threat, and it gets it wrong all the time. So part of my worry is that we sort of rely on the technology to guide us, thinking that it's really effective, and then we don't develop the actual sort of human-to-human techniques we need to grapple with the pandemic, and then the risk increases.
That's Ruha Benjamin, Associate Professor of African American Studies and author of Race After Technology. Ruha, thank you so much for joining us.
It's really my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Just a little more than 4 months until Election Day, we're going to check in regularly on congressional races. For this week's district profile, it's Ohio's first congressional district, where Republican incumbent Congressman Steve Chabot is facing a challenge from Democrat Kate Schroeder. Howard Wilkinson is senior political analyst for WVXU Cincinnati Public Radio and joins us now. Howard, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, just tell us a little bit about this district. What does it encompass?
This district is basically two counties in southwest Ohio, Hamilton County, which is where Cincinnati is located, which has become a very blue county, and Warren County, directly to the north, which is a very red county.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republicans in the legislature added Warren County to this district in 2011 after the last census. Basically, to protect Chabot from some very tough challenges he had earlier in his congressional career.
Well, let's talk about Chabot. He has represented this district for more than 20 years, though not continuously. Here is a recent ad touting his response to the pandemic, which included voting for the Paycheck Protection Program for businesses.
Congressman Steve Chabot is helping us get through the coronavirus crisis, listening to the concerns of residents, getting them in touch with medical experts, securing support for Ohio small businesses.
Now, we do not hear his voice there. He actually hasn't been doing a lot of interviews or holding public meetings either.
No.
Tell us about how he is positioning himself in this race.
Well, as you hear on that ad, I mean, he's obviously trying to position himself as somebody who has had an impact and a positive impact in terms of the pandemic. One of the complaints about him in recent years has been that he's been a do-nothing member of Congress. He hasn't really accomplished much, and now they're starting to fight back a little bit with ads like this one.
How closely has Congressman Chabot aligned himself with President Trump, and is that going to be a factor in this race?
That could be very well be a factor. He's aligned himself pretty closely with him on most votes, but in terms of campaigning, I think he's going to try to keep an arm's length away from Trump. Mm. Even in Warren County, which is very Republican, there's starting to be a change in the electorate there, particularly among women voters, that associating yourself with Trump in this district is not really the way to go. Hamilton County voted for Clinton in 2016. Warren County was for Trump, but it was one of the lower margins in Ohio. Most Republicans are getting the message from their parties, just steer clear. Run your own campaigns. Don't run with the president.
Let's talk about the challenger, Democrat Kate Schroeder. She is a cancer mm-hmm. survivor and is campaigning on expanding access to healthcare. Listen.
Too many people have to choose between the care they need and risking lifelong debt for their family. And that's not okay. Cancer reinforced my commitment to service. It reminded me that life is short and most meaningful when we're connecting with and helping others.
What more can you tell us about Kate Schroeder?
Kate Schroeder is an interesting person. I mean, she did work for the Clinton Foundation for their healthcare initiative and spent a lot of time in Africa working on public health programs, mostly for children. And she has a background in this. She's worked with the Cincinnati Health Department. Her father, who also ended up dying of cancer, was a very well-known oncologist in Cincinnati. you know, she comes from that background. I mean, she's rooted in health issues and public health in particular.
And what are the polls saying about the race at this point?
Jeremy, the only poll I have actually seen, and it was from the DCCC, Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, it looked to me like a fairly legitimate, straight up poll, had a dead heat between the two of them in the district. Even more surprisingly, it had a 4 or 5 percentage point lead for Joe Biden over Donald Trump. Democrats are looking at this in Washington. DCCC just put it on their red to blue list and are going to start pouring some resources into this district because they think they have an opportunity here.
It's very interesting because it was about a year ago that I was in Cincinnati to cover a Trump rally, and it was a very big Trump rally with, 20,000+ people lining up there at the arena to see the president and the vice president and the governor of Ohio. That is Howard Wilkinson, who is a senior political analyst for WVXU Cincinnati Public Radio, talking with us about Ohio's first congressional district and the race for Congress there. Howard, thank you.
Good to be here.
And we are going to be checking in on different congressional races around the country as we head up to Election Day in just over 4 months. Here in Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.